Okay. This lecture, entitled Rabbinic Legislation, Its Authority and History, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Dr. and Mrs. Paul and Miri Zeidel and their children, Alexandra and Parker. In previous lectures, we cover the life and religious philosophy of Dr. Zacharias Frankel, the founder of the Positive Historical School of Judaism, and his belief in the progressive or historic changes which the entirety of Judaism, including the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, underwent over time. This philosophy formed the original basis of conservative Judaism in America. As we pointed out in the previous lecture, this view, at least as it applies to the Torah Sheba'al Peh, runs counter to the entire Talmudic tradition of the oral law's divinity and its historic origins from the time of the revelation on Mount Sinai. Now, although in its basic legal and belief system, the Judaism of today is virtually the same as the Judaism as it was given in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, time of Moses, in regards to rabbinic law, however, as well as law based upon minhag, custom, the Talmud is replete with examples of evolution over time. To better understand the basis and history of rabbinic legislation and the system by which it allows it to undergo change, let us first begin with the following quote from Avos, Ethics of the Fathers, in the name of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, who were the rabbinic leaders at the time of the beginning of the Second Temple period. They realized the pressing need to revitalize Jewish life after the destruction of the First Commonwealth and Temple. The following was their constant refrain, and this is the beginning of your notes. This is, the men of the Great Assembly used to say three things. Have masunim badin, be deliberate in judgment, tamidu salmidim harbe, establish many disciples, be asu siyog la Torah, and make a protective fence around the Torah. The idea of creating a fence in order to ensure the integrity of the Torah is an approach the Torah itself takes, as we see in the following medrash in paragraph B. This medrash is Bamidbar Rabbah. In addition, the Torah forbade all that is produced by the grapevine, substances that are not intoxicating. In other words, a Nazarite is primarily his vow, as it relates to consumption, is wine, is fermented grapes. But yet the Torah forbids grapes, raisins, anything related to the grapevine. Because a person is required, the Medrash says, to distance himself from that which is repulsive and that which appears to be so, or anything that faintly even resembles it. From this we see that the Torah created a protective fence to preserve its utterances. We were taught there, in Avos, be deliberate in judgment, establish many disciples, and make a protective fence around the Torah. How should a person make a protective fence around the Torah? Just like the Torah did. In other words, the Rabbanim were given a mandate to duplicate the similar, when they see, of course, where there's a real need, to follow that which the Torah has created. Behold, it is stated, this is regarding the laws of family purity. Also, you should not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is put apart for her menstrual uncleanliness. Since I would think that one is allowed to hug and kiss her and have idle conversation with her, the scriptures state you shall not approach her, loisikra, as the Torah forbade even that which may lead eventually to marital relations. So marital relations is the core prohibition. And the Medrash understands this, the hugging, whatever it is a fence which the Torah itself created. In addition, we find other allusions for the need of creating fences, such as in the following, here in paragraph C. The discussion there is a Gemara in Yevamos and Chof Aleph in 21, 21a and b, that there are shniyos, there are prohibited relations of incest which the Torah itself does not forbid, but rabbinically they created a fence. One example is a grandmother. The mother the Torah forbids expressly. The grandmother the Torah does not. Rabbinically, it's forbidden. So the Talmud says, where in the Torah may an allusion be found to the prohibition relations in the second degree, such as grandmother, etc.? Rav Kahana says it may be derived from here. And quoting a pasuk in Vayikra Yudches and Leviticus 18, Ushmartim es mishmarti. Therefore you shall keep my, or, well, it's guard, Ushmartim, guard, should keep, my ordinance, really my keeping. That you not commit any one of these abominable customs which are committed before you, that you defile not yourselves in it, I am the Lord your God. The Talmud understands, keep, in other words, the mishmarti, says, shmar, that which I gave you to guard, guard that. Asu mishmeris le mishmarti, provide a keeping to my keeping. Abai asked Rav Yosef, this then is surely mandated by the Torah. I mean, we know this is rabbinic law and not Torah law. If you're going to say that the Torah really commands us to put this protective fence, then it really becomes Torah law. Rav Yosef replied, it is Torah law, but the rabbis have interpreted it. To this Abai responded, all the Torah is subject to interpretation by the rabbis, but its laws after interpretation are still considered to be Torah law. Second degree relations, however, are only rabbinic. Rather than the prohibition of second degree relations is actually rabbinical. In other words, at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, it was not forbidden. It was forbidden subsequently. Actually, the Gemara, as we're going to see, traces it to the time of Shlomo HaMelech, the time of Solomon. While the scriptural text is a support or scriptural hint, asmachta, empowering them to do so. In other words, it's a hint basically informing us when you see the need, then the Sanhedrin, which is the legislative body of the Jewish people, are empowered or mandated to create this legislation. But it was not created at the very time of the Torah. The Gemara, just as an example, just that the understanding when it says asmachta here does not mean that the scripture is not referring to it at all, but rather it's just saying that the mandate is there, but it was not specifically forbidden at that point in time. We see from the I just quote here from Rashi and on the top of page 2, this is Rashi and Bay and Bezo and Bez and 2b. There the Gemara makes a statement, Ein goyshem gzeira l'gzeira. One does not, when the Sanhedrin comes to make a decree, they make decrees to protect Torah laws, not to protect rabbinic laws. And Rashi just said, because the whole mandate to create protections is shmartim es mishmarti. You should protect mine. V'loy mishmeris l'mishmeris. Not a protective layer on top of another protective layer. The mandate is, though, to create protective layers on the Torah itself. Although we find precedence from the Torah itself for the implementation of protective legislation or fences, and it seems clear that the sages received their mandate for such legislation from Sinai. In fact, Moshe Rabbeinu himself seems to have enacted rabbinic legislation, as we will soon see. Where in Scripture itself are these powers alluded to? In other words, that you have to listen to the Rabbanim. I would first like to quote to you from Parsha Shoftim. It says, Ki yipol m'chol dover, if there arises a matter too hard for you in judgment, between blood and blood, plea and plea, in other words, civics is a civil law, between plague and plague, being matters of controversy inside your gates. Now this is understood to be that the Shar, the gates, is referring to the place where the Sanhedrin sat. And if there's a question within the Sanhedrin,
Within, of course, there is the great Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim, near the Beis HaMikdash, but there are the minor courts. They're also called Sanhedrin Katana, the minor courts. Within the minor courts, there's a question which is not resolved. Some have a clear opinion one way, some have a clear opinion the other way. There's not a clear majority here. Maybe others are not certain. So you take this question, then shall you arise and go get to the place which the Lord your God shall choose. There shall come to the priests, the Levites, and the judge who shall be in those days and inquire. It's understood that the Sanhedrin is made up to a large extent of priests and Levites because they are the ones that are supported by the community to be involved in the study and teaching of Torah. And they primarily are the ones who make up the Sanhedrin. Of course, anyone who is talented can rise to that. But it's understood that generally every Sanhedrin is made up of Kohanim and Levium, just because they, as a class, are supported for that purpose. And inquire, and they shall declare to you the sentence of judgment. Thus, at that point is, they come, either if they have a tradition, just like the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, if they have a tradition, they tell you what the tradition is, they're the servant. If they don't, they have to work it out themselves. You know, using the method, the Yud Gimel Midas, the 13 ways of interpretation, they work it out themselves and they issue a judgment. And you shall do according to the sentence which they, of that place that the Lord shall choose, shall declare to you. And you shall take care to do according to all that they inform you, according to the sense of the Torah which they shall teach you, and according to the judgment which they shall tell you, you shall do. And the language says, Al Piyater Shal Yerucha, this is which they guide you. And then it says, you shall not turn aside from the decision. Actually, the word, the Torah uses Dovar, which is word, which they shall declare to you, Asher Yagidu Lachem, says, to the right hand nor to the left. And the man who will act presumptuously and will not listen to the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God, or to the judge, as if the judge could be from another tribe, that man shall die. As if he goes, it's understood, if he does not follow the dictates of that, of the Sanhedrin HaGdolah, the great court, goes back, he is a judge himself of a minor court. And he rules according to his opinion, defies the ruling of the Supreme Court, and rules, then he is a Zaken Mamre. He is an elder who is rebellious, and the man shall die. You shall put away the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and do more and do no more presumptuously. This is the parsha. The Gemara understands this to be that which is loisoser, which is the addition here. It doesn't say Yisher Rucho, and it says. And it just says again, min hadover, it understands this to be not only in interpretation, but anything they tell you, even in legislation. Anything that they tell you. And from here, the Gemara understands that this is the Gemara in Bracha, so you can look at yourself. Gemara understands that there is, if one violates rabbinic legislation, one is in violation of loisoser, going against any word that they say. There's not just interpretation, which of course is the thrust of this, but the fact is, it says min hadover, we derive, says that anything they say. And in fact, it would seem to be something that that's really part of regular life. On top of page 3, I quote from the Gemara in Sukkah. And the Gemara says in 46a, it says in Memvova Madalef, what is the bracha that one makes when lighting Chanukah, the lamps of Chanukah? And we say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kedishonu B'mitzvosav, V'tzivonu. He sanctified us, says, by your commandments, and you commanded us
Lahadlik ner Chanukah, shel Chanukah, to kindle the lights of Chanukah. So Chanukah is a rabbinic commandment. It's a difference when we matzah perhaps, we take a lulav, it was the first day, so it was commanded by the Torah. But it's not commanded by the Torah. But where did he command us? So the Gemara says the command is deduced from the pasuk, says, lois saucer, you shall not turn aside. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchok replied, it is derived, he has a different, he understands lois saucer to be understood in the general context of the verse, to mean interpretation, and not legislation, and he has another verse. Ask your father, declare unto your elders, and they will tell you that the Torah gave, according to Rav Nachman bar Yitzchok, power to the elders, that one has to listen to everything that they say. But it seems from other Gemaras that the first opinion is the most accepted, that it's lois saucer. This is how the Rambam understands this in his preface to Mishneh Torah, in paragraph C and page 3. The Talmud contains all those things that the sages and prophets decreed throughout every generation in order to make a protective fence around the Torah, as they directly heard from Moshe, as it says, Ushmartim es mishmarti. Therefore shall you keep my ordinance, my keeping. Asu mishmeris lemishmarti. Provide a keeping to my keeping. In other words, it's saying that I gave you these laws, but I want you to create a protect. If you feel the necessity, create a protective fence. Similarly, it contains elucidations of those customs and ordinances which were instituted and acted, this is about the Talmud, throughout every generation by the Beis Din of each particular generation as they saw fit, for it is forbidden to turn aside from them. As it is stated, and again the Rambam quotes this verse, you shall not turn aside from the decision or the word, dover, which they shall declare to you to the right hand nor to the left. Likewise, the Talmud contains those legal issues and difficult judgments which the sages had not received a direct tradition from Moshe and needed to be analyzed by the Sanhedrin of that generation using the Midos, principles of derivation through which the Torah is expounded and the sages' final decision regarding the matter. And that's also part of what's contained in the Talmud that involves the interpretation. So one is legislation and one is interpretation. All of these decrees, customs, legislation, decisions in the time of Moshe to his own time were put together by Rav Ashi in the Talmud. But again, he reiterates the Rambam that the Rabbanim were empowered to make legislation and we were required to listen to them. Now it's interesting, the Ramban, Nachmanides, disagrees with the Rambam. At least in his what he wrote is, when he was younger, he wrote his Hasagas, he wrote a critique of the Rambam's, Rambam wrote a Sefer HaMitzvahs. He went through the 613 mitzvahs, and he has a Hagdoma, he has a preface to it, where he describes 14 principles upon which he based his new system of evaluation, what is a mitzvah, what's not a mitzvah. And the Ramban wrote a critique. He wrote a critique on the introduction and he wrote a critique on individual mitzvahs. So this is taken from the Ramban's critique from the first of the 14 principles upon which the Rambam based his numerical system, 613. And he says, however, the decrees and ordinances which the sages created in order to ensure the integrity of the Torah's offense, to protect it, are not covered by the prohibition, you shall not turn aside from the decision which they declare to you to the right hand nor to the left. That verse is merely used as support or hint, asmachta. The law of rebellious judge, Azok and Mamre, does not apply to them at all. This is what the Ramban wrote. Although we are of the opinion that the prohibition of you shall not turn aside does not apply to rabbinic legislation, it is nevertheless customary amongst the sages to express themselves using that verse, since they were empowered by him, by Hashem, may he be blessed, through the tradition from Sinai to institute legislation and bring order to Jewish society. And they expounded the Torah using hints and gematrias. In other words, he is saying that which it says, where they use the word, loisosim en hadover, from the thing,
which would seem to imply broader than just the interpretation, is a hint. And as the simple meaning is still in the context as referring to interpretation. By that, it's hinting at it. It's hinting at that there's also something here, but its real base is a tradition that comes all the way back from Moshe to Sinai. That's how the Ramban understands it in his critique. Later on in his life, he wrote his famous commentary to the Torah. In that commentary, it seems he reversed himself. And he maintains, like the Rambam, that there really is the prohibition of Lois Sosser, you shall not turn aside, applies also to rabbinic law. And he says as follows, that which the sages instituted, this is on, it's going on the prohibition of you're not allowed to add to the Torah. But that which the sages instituted as a protective fence, such as the prohibition of secondary relatives, is a fulfillment of a command of the Torah. Provided the person realizes that these laws are merely a protective fence and not a commandment from the mouth of the Holy One, blessed be He in the Torah. In other words, Ramban says the Rabbanan have the right. The Torah itself gave them the right to legislate, but the people should realize and know the difference between that which is commanded directly by Hashem and that which is only a fence. One of the things that is brought up in this discussion is, for that reason, perhaps, that we know when we have a suffix deraisa, when we have a question of Torah law, we go l'chumra, we're stringent. But in rabbinic law, we go l'kula, we take liberties with it. And one of the, even though one could argue, well, it's all Torah law, because there are, another, if I violate it, I'm in violation of the prohibition of going against the Rabbanan, which is also Torah law. But they specifically created this kula, this leniency. So it should be evident what is a deraisa and what is a derabbanan. What is by Torah law, what's mandated. You should not make that confusion. You should realize that there are, when I'm doing it, it isn't because intrinsically it's a law. It's only because they wanted to create a fence. And therefore, the mitzvah is listening to them. Not the actual act itself is forbidden. But listening to them is that which is, or not rebelling against them is the mitzvah. They wanted to make it clear. Rabbeinu Bachya, who often goes in the footsteps of the Ramban in his commentary, expands upon this and says the following. That which our sage of blessed memory instituted in their protective fences are not considered as an addition to the Torah, for they only come to protect the essence, which like one makes a fence surrounding a vineyard in order to protect the vineyard. This is akin to the statement, go take a circuitous route, O Nazarite, but not approach the vineyard. On the contrary, he who violates one of their laws that was made as a fence or as an improvement to fix the ills of society is in violation of a negative commandment. You shall not turn aside. Similarly, the Torah command, Ushmartim es mishmarti, therefore you shall keep my ordinance, my keeping. And our sage says this means asu mishmeres limishmarti, provide a keeping, a fence to my keeping. Now, once a rabbinic law has become widely accepted, and has already become part of Jewish practice, it acquires a character which is akin to Torah law and is not easily subject to annulment. We want to change it. Now there's a rabbinic law, and we feel that it should be changed. It's very difficult to change it. As we now read here, is on the bottom here of page 4. I first quote from a Gemara in Erev in the Chof Aleph on the Beis. It begins with the interpreting a verse from Shir Hashirim, Song of Songs. Chadoshim gam yishonim doidi tzafanti lo. New and old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. And I've looked forward for it. The congregation of Israel said to the Holy One, blessed be He, Lord of the universe, I have imposed upon myself more restrictions than you have imposed upon me.
and I have observed them. Rabbi Chisda asked one of the young rabbis who was reciting Agadato in his presence in a certain order, did you hear what was the meaning of the expression new and old? Now, this is a person who was arranging it, like we have in the Medrash Rabbah. So he was a person who compiled Midrashim. He asked him, what does it mean, new and old? So the former, the other replied, are the minor, and the latter are the major commandments. And Rukhizda replied, was then the Torah, Rukhizda asked, given on two different occasions? What's new and old? Rather, the latter are those derived from the words of the Torah, that's the old, while the former are those derived from the words of the scribes, and between the Rabbanim. Rava made the following exposition. What is the meaning of the scriptural test? And further, my son, be admonished of making many books. There's different interpretations. So it's more important. My son, be more careful in the observance of the words of the scribes, I mean referring to the rabbinic legislation, than the words of the Torah. For the words of the Torah, there are positive and negative precepts. That's the laws of the scribes. Whoever transgresses any of the enactments of the scribes incurs the penalty of death. And Rashi explains, quoting a pasuk in Koheles, in Perek Yud, Ecclesiastes 10:8, whoever breaks a hedge, referring to Peretz Geder, is a fence, a serpent shall bite him. Notice, be careful. There's a protective fence. Hashem honors that legislation. It's rabbinical. But they were mandated to make it. And if one violates it, there's consequences. Now it seems, as we're going, that there's a difference. We say that there's a divine death penalty for violating rabbinic law. I mean, of course, it means if you're doing it b'mezid, you're doing it willfully. There seems to be a difference of how one violates this. And this is on page 5, paragraph B. Reb Zrika said, name of Rabbi Elazar, whoever makes light of washing the hand, mezalzel, of washing the hands, before and after a meal, will be uprooted from the world. Nekar min olam. Tosfos explains, quotes Rashi also, quotes, what does it mean, nekar from the world, uprooted from the world? Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben, this is Ben Shmuel, the great grandson of Rashi, found Rashi's explanation very puzzling. Rashi explained that the phrase uprooted from the world is equivalent to the phrase whoever transgresses any of the enactments of the scribes incurs the death penalty of death. That is, nekar min olam, uprooted, is equivalent to death. And he says, but if that were the case, argued Rabbeinu Yitzchak, then why was washing of the hands in particular singled out, as this punishment applies to all rabbinic law? In addition, here the punishment of negligence of washing hands, according to Rashi, is the penalty of death. Whereas in the chapter, it says, the Gemara states that the punishment is impoverishment. It seems that the punishment of someone who is constantly making light of washing his hands. I mean, they said this because it was a relatively new legislation. It hadn't really becomes widespread, and people were taking liberty and were not washing their hands. So people constantly make light of washing his hands is becoming uprooted through poverty, which is worse than actual death. This crushing poverty. And I quote in the bottom, page 5, from the Gemara in Erevin, Mem Aleph Amud Beis, 41b, three kinds of person do not see the face of Gehenna. Don't see Gehenna, don't see purgatory hell. One who suffers from oppressive poverty, one who's afflicted with bowel diseases, and one who's in the hands of the Roman government is pursued by creditors. In other words, he doesn't have a life. He's always being pursued. This is this pressing, this crushing poverty is a pain which is, if a person has that on this earth, he's suffering the pains of Gehenna on this earth. He won't see Gehenna. But he says that's even worse than the divine punishment of death. So really it's a difference of how one that we're speaking up until now in terms of divine punishment. But there's also human punishment in violating rabbinic law. And here on top of page 6, Rabbi Yehuda said, this is from a Mishnah in Idios. Far be it from us to think that Akavya ben Mahalala was excommunicated. For the doors, there was a question about that regarding a comment that he made. For the doors of the temple hall did not close on any man in Israel the equal of Akavya ben Mahalala in wisdom and purity and the fear of sin. Whom did they in fact excommunicate? It was a Relozer ben Chanoich, who raised doubts about washing the hands. He was mefakbek, in other words, he didn't take it seriously. And when he died, the Beis Din Sanhedrin sent and had a large stone placed on his coffin. Teacher, if a man is excommunicated and dies in his excommunication, says the Beis Din stones his coffin. It's not stone, but it's one large stone. And it's brought in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch that deals with the Shin Lamed Aleph in Yoredeiah 334. It says there are 24 crimes which warrant the Nidui punishment. In the previous class, in the last year, we spoke at length about Nidui. Number four was one who makes light of even one rabbinic law, and most certainly a Torah law. Again, but this means he habitually makes light.
What does
need to
excommunication?
Yeah, excommunication. Really, one of the classes I gave last year, I speak about it at length. Now, the whole movement of reform was focused upon changing the current legal, or then current legal, or ritual system for one that was more, in their eyes, more in keeping with the sensitivities and needs of the many acculturated Jews of the period. Let's now touch upon the basis for any change of prior rabbinic legislation as is presented in Talmud. In other words, up until now, I discussed the basis, the right, the mandate for the Rabbanan to legislate. We spoke about the punishment for those who do not listen to the Rabbanan. Now I'm speaking about the mechanics of change. Here, on page 6, this is on paragraph A, this is taken from the Mishnah Edios, on the first paragraph, the first chapter. And why do they record the opinion of a single person among the many? When the halacha must be in accordance with the opinion of the many, this is why does the Mishnah bother of quoting a minority opinion? Because when the reader who is faced sees the Mishnah and sees the opinions, is directed to follow the majority. So why even mention the minority? So, and the answer is so that if a court prefers the opinion of the single person, a later court may rely upon him. For no court may set aside the decision of another court unless it is greater than it in wisdom and in number or age. In other words, if it had been legislated and there was a minor opinion that had been outvoted, a later Beis Din can rely on that and rule according to that opinion.
So,
and that's why those opinions, minority opinions, were mentioned. If it was greater than it is wisdom, but if there be, again, if it had not stated the minority opinion, and this later Beis Din was greater in wisdom but not in number or age, that's the question of minyan. Does it mean there's more scholars or are there of greater age and greater experience? In number or age but not in wisdom, or the opposite, it may not set aside its decision. Unless it is greater than it says in both wisdom and in number. In other words, if there would have been just a majority opinion, then a subsequent Beis Din to overturn that would have to be a superior court. However, if there's a minority opinion which is stated in the Mishnah, a smaller court can rely upon that minority opinion if it's stated in the Mishnah.
We're speaking about the
rabbinic opinion. In other words, that which the place of the Sanhedrin, all of the great scholars come together, as they did in Bovel, as in the time of Rav Ashi. And if they went and see that that the minor opinion is their advice more valid, they can rule according to that minor opinion.
Assuming that they are of greater
intellect. No. Even if they're smaller. But if there is a minority opinion, then the smaller one could rely on the minority opinion.
Even though in doing so, they're rejecting the majority opinion?
Correct. But they have under those circumstances, the minority opinion, the later Besdin can rule like the minority opinion.
So the only time we need a greater Besdin is if there's no minority opinion.
Correct. And that's why the minority, that's right, that's why the minority opinion was stated in the Mishnah, to allow the later Besdin, which is inferior, to rule according to that opinion. Had it not been stated, it would assume that this is a generally held opinion, I mean, there's no place for argument then a later court could not, unless it would be superior. We have, now, there's an exception. One exception, of course, is to the rule that you need a greater Besdin if the minority, we know of the minority opinion, was stated when it was stated. There's another situation where an inferior court can overturn the ruling of a superior court. And that's here on page 7. And leave you just some background for this. We had really touched upon this before, and when we sent the first lecture of this series about intermarriage, there was a combined assembly of members of Beit Shammai, the school of Shammai, and the schools of Hillel, and they legislated 18 laws. One of the areas of laws that they are laws pertaining to intermarriage. They forbade drinking non-Jewish wine. They forbade eating non-Jewish bread. And there's no question if it's commercial, it's different. But under normal, so everyone the non-Jewish bread that comes from a private householder, a balabos, a non-Jew, even if it would be kosher, there's a question of the ingredients, it cannot be eaten. That's part of that legislation. They also forbade oil that was prepared by non-Jews as part, even though there's a kosher partially consideration, that itself would not have been decisive. There's a possibility that there may be problems of kosher. The underlying thing was the less you had to do with non-Jews, the less likely it is of assimilation. So it was all part of that legislation. A later Besdin of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel was before this temple was destroyed. It was the early part of the first century. The Mishnah was completed during the lifetime of Yehuda HaNasi, who died in the year, say, approximately the year 192 of the Common Era. His grandson, who's called Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, just to make that the Aramaic word for Nasi, he was also Nasi, his name was Rabbi Yehuda, and he was called the prince, but to make a distinction, they called Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, the Aramaic for prince, convened a Besdin and voided the original legislation and allowed Jews everywhere to use non-Jewish oil. And this is the discussion is how was he allowed to do so? So here, Rabbi Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta came from Eretz Yisrael. Here, Rabbi Simloy expounded in the Sibas and Tzivit. As regards oil, Rabbi Yehuda, he's a grandson of Yehuda Nasi, and his court, Beis Din, took a vote and declared it permitted. And the Gemara asked, how then was it possible for Yehuda, the prince, the grandson of Yehuda Nasi, to permit what was forbidden by the ordinance of the disciples of Shammai and Hillel? Seeing that we have learned a court is unable to annul the decisions of another court unless it is superior to it in wisdom and numerical strength. Furthermore, Rabbi Bar-Chana has said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, in all matters a court can annul the decision of another court except the 18 things prohibited by the school of Hillel and Shammai, for even were Eliyo and his court to come, assumptions they are greater than Shammai and Hillel, the yeshiva Shammai and Hillel. If they were to come and declare them permitted, we must not listen to him. So this is part of the 18, this legislation of oil is part of the general 18 prohibitions. The Mishaisha said the reason that these 18 things form an exception, one is unable to annul them, is because their prohibition has spread among the large majority of Israelites. But the prohibition concerning oil did not so spread. From Shmuel Bar Abasa, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, our master sat and made investigation concerning the use of heathens' oil and found that its prohibition had not spread among the large majority of Israelites. They accordingly relied upon the dictum of Shimon ben Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer ben Tzadok, who declared, we make no decree upon the community unless the majority are able to abide by it. Rabbi Adar bar Abba said, what scriptural verse supports this rule? And it quotes a pasuk. But here we have another klal, another principle. That a legislation, in a sense, to be binding in a way that it cannot be overturned, has to be accepted by the majority. If it's not accepted by the majority, in a situation where it's not clear if it was accepted by the majority or not, it wasn't that people just from day one said, we're not going to do this. But some did and some not. It's not clear if there's a majority or not. Rabbinically, we still have to abide by it. However, a second court who sees the problem and decides it's not worth to press further, like sometimes they say, well, let's give encourage it. We feel there's a need here. It serves a purpose. So let's reconvene and again declare a prohibition. And we'll enhance this. But there are times it says it's just not going to work. You know, the sociological conditions are such, it's just not going to work. So they can go and they will go and they have the right to decide, okay, it'll be a no. So again, we have another situation where a lower court, an inferior court, can annul legislation of a superior court, is in a situation where it did not take hold. And that's the situation with Beis Shammai and Hillel. I mean, they waited some time, but even after all those years had passed, over 100 years, it still did not take hold.
Right, so the other case is when there's a minority opinion in the Mishnah.
Right. The first is there was a minority opinion in the Mishnah, that an inferior court could rule like the minority opinion. And the second is if it did not take hold. Now I'm going to as an aside here, I just quoted the Tosfos without translating it. And Tosfos analyzes, but it seems those 18 are special. And it would seem in other legislation, if something took hold, a superior court could overrule it. Another, not the 18, just the regular thing. If you need a government of Chokhmah Minyan, it has to be, and if it would be greater.
What are the 18? The 18 can't.
You cannot, that's what he quoted, it cannot be annulled.
Those 18 cannot be annulled.
Right.
Under
any circumstance. Why? So this is what Tosfos deals with, and he says, and he quotes Yerushalmi, that the originally the members of Hillel
the Beis Hillel felt there was no necessity to make this legislation. They were overruled by the Beis Shammai that was a majority in that assembly. But there was evidently a very impassioned minority. And the Shammai, they stuck a sword, at least maybe it's proverbial, in the Beis Medrash, because anyone who leaves, you have to stay for this vote, will be killed. It was extremely impassioned. And when they made that legislation, they said, this can never be, in other words, normal legislation can be overturned, voided by a greater court. This cannot. And because it was really, they put themselves out, because they really felt that the Jews at this point, this was the end of the Second Temple period. This was the beginning of a long Golus, of a long exile. And they felt and they saw that society, that things needed to be protected. And all of those 18 are really protective measures. And they felt, Shem, were very impassioned, that they were very necessary. And eventually, the Gemara says in Shabbos, that Beis Hillel came around to the thinking of Beis Shammai. They eventually came around. But that day, when they were arguing about it, it was extremely impassioned. And they made it so that nobody could overturn this. That was part of the passion of creating this. But still in all, it would only be considered rabbinic legislation had it took hold of the majority of the people. Oil, in this particular case, did not take hold. And therefore, that's why a minority, an inferior court could overrule this.
Use the oil out of each employee.
Yes. Yeah. It's a subcategory of one of the 18. Now there's another. We explained these. Now there's another situation. There's two more situations where rabbinic legislation could be overturned by an inferior court. One is, there's a halacha that if there was a stated reason for the original legislation, and the original legislation, though, does not seem that the reason is valid, it still is in force unless a Sanhedrin, as a, will analyze this, sit down, and then declare, says, well, the reason, therefore, is no longer valid, and we will now void this legislation. But it has to be officially voided.
By another, even
an inferior court. Right. But it has to be a Sanhedrin. I myself can't make that decision. If it was legislated, and there's a known reason, but that it has to be. There still needs a Sanhedrin, a court represent the Jewish people. If it was, and to review this, and to put their okay, it's no longer. There's no reason to do this anymore, and they have the right to void this. So again, we have a situation of an inferior court that will void, the rulings of a superior court. But originally there was a stated reason. It was evident what the reason was. And then they can go even inferior court and say, well, the reason no longer exists at all. The next one that I quote from, again, you can look at yourself at the time, is there's a situation where the original court created a clause in the legislation saying that if a subsequent court comes on, even as inferior, reviews this and sees that there's no need anymore, it should be voided, they are empowered to void this. And that was part of the original legislation. Because that's the Gemara in Moed Kotten and Gimel Amud Beis. So here, again, we have an additional reason. So let me just... Let's summarize. We just says the first is, if there's a minority opinion which is stated in the Mishnah, we know that there was a
then in that case an inferior court can overturn the ruling of the majority and follow the minority. Second, if the original legislation was not accepted by a majority of the populace. Again, it's really not binding. I mean, rabbinically it's binding, of course, but even a lower court can now...
An
inferior court can now overturn the void of the original legislation. Three, if the stated reasoning of the first legislation is no longer applicable because it's due to completely changed circumstances, I mean, it's no longer here. Again, we need... an individual can't void this, but a Sanhedrin sitting down and saying that it no longer applies can void the original legislation. And finally, if there was an express stipulation in the original legislation that granted authority to a later inferior based in court to overturn, if they see that it warrants and they empower the lower court to void this, then the lower court can void this. Yeah.
Is one of the 18 that we are not allowed to read Pasakum?
Yeah, so one of them is Pasakum. So there is a... that everyone agrees, I mean, that it's a whole discussion, in Pasakum, with non-Jewish bread, everyone agrees that if it's made by a non-Jew in his own home, it's not made commercially, then this prohibition applies. The question is by paspalter and commercial non-Jewish bread. Does it apply? There's a whole discussion. Does it apply completely or it doesn't apply at all? Or it applies when no other kind of bread is available. But if you can get, if bread that is made from a Jewish source is available, then you're not allowed to even take from the commercial, the paspalter. It's a whole halachic discussion. But that's clear that bread that's made by an individual householder, balabos, who's a non-Jew, you cannot eat that bread. That's the... It's interesting to note that all, or at least most of the rabbis that were gathered together at the various reform assemblies in Brunswick, Braunschweig, this is Frankfurt and Breslau, had some familiarity to the source material that we quoted. I mean, most of them, or a good number of them, had smicha, you know, a smicha that was given not today, but it was given many years ago. And knew that their efforts did not receive Talmudic sanction. In a previous lecture, we quoted the reaction of the chief rabbi of Prague, Rav Shlomo Yehuda Leib Rappaport, a person who was involved in Wissenschaft, the critical analysis of Jewish texts and history, and someone who maintained personal friendships with many of those associated with Reform. Addressing himself directly to the Assembly of Frankfurt in 1845, he quoted from the previously mentioned Mishnah and Idios, his name Bezdin Yochel Vachel Divrei Bezdin Chavere Ache Godel Memeno B'Chochm of Minyan. No court may set aside the decrees of another court, unless it is greater than is in wisdom and in number. Since the Reform Rabbinic Assembly could not make such a claim, it was wrong and sinful for them to attempt any such changes. This is what Rav Rappaport wrote. He also told them, although they were under pressure to make changes by their constituents, they should merely respond to them that the sole task of the rabbinate is to teach people all that has been transmitted from former generations. Any permissible change would naturally occur without their premeditated intervention. In Rappaport's words, quote, "Should there be among our customs and laws some matter which requires reform or renewal, it is the passage of time which will bring about the reform or renewal," end quote. That last statement regarding spontaneous change over time needs clarification, but it goes beyond the limitations of the lecture. But suffice it to say, Rav Rappaport was a dear friend of Dr. Zacharias Frankel, who held a similar opinion. In other words, he was referring to the evolutionary change, which is not really the traditional view of how change is created. Now evidently those who did not heed Rip Rappaport's address no longer believed in the historical veracity of the Talmud, did not feel duty-bound to follow its guidelines. It's interesting, though, that they continued to call themselves rabbis, i.e. teachers of Torah, rather than Reform ministers. So they kept the name rabbi. They viewed themselves as a part of the rabbinic tradition. But in fact, they were not. Now, the truth is that there has been considerable historic change throughout the generations, but all of it was made in order to enhance the spirituality of Jewry and their adherence to halacha. To give you a sense of these changes, I'd like to trace some of the major rabbinic legislation that occurred from the time of the founding of the Jewish people to the beginning of the Second Temple period. I'm just going to summarize. We're going to basically... The Gemara says that the davening three times a day, Shacharis, Mincha, and Ma'ariv, was instituted by the Ovis, by the patriarchs. From the time of the Ovis, Jews daven three times a day. On every Yontif, one studies the laws of Pesach on Pesach, Shavuos on Shavuos, Sukkos on Sukkos. That was mandated by Moshe Rabbeinu. He also instituted the reading of the Torah on Shabbos and Yontif, Rish Chodesh, Chol HaMoed. This was all instituted by Moshe. And the Gemara goes in Bava Kamma explains, as you can look at this, that the prophets at the time, at the time of Moshe, means all of the Jewry, they enacted the reading on Shabbos, and the break till Monday, the breaks is till Thursday, and then to Shabbos. The 3 days don't pass by without the reading of the Torah. The Nusa, the Gemara says that, our the first bracha that we say in benching, in grace after meals, Hazona Shalom Kulo Betuvo, that was the Nusa for the general that was created by Moshe Rabbeinu. The Yerushalmi in Ksuba says that which we have, the 7 days, the Shivas Yimei Mishta, the 7 day festivity for Chos and Akala, and the 7 days of Avelis were instituted by Moshe Rabbeinu. Even though, of course, there are hints to it, that it was a common practice, we find by Leah, Yaakov, Leah, Rachel, about Shmala Shvuazois, about the 7 days of festivities. And we know about 7 days of Avelis, but it was to make it binding, it was just a common custom. But rabbinically binding, it was instituted by Moshe.
Was he allowed?
What? Because you're asking why not?
Why could Moshe?
Moshe is the head of the Sanhedrin.
Oh, as the head of the Sanhedrin.
Moshe is the head of the Sanhedrin.
As the
head of the Sanhedrin instituted it. It was a common custom. It's a fulfillment. There is the idea of the Simcha of Chos and Vekala. That's part of the covet of the mace, the honor of the. It was a common custom, but he institutionalized it. He is the head of the Sanhedrin. This is real legislation. We go on, we quote the Gemara in Tainus that the arrangement of the various Kohanim, the Mishmoris, how they served in the Beis Hamikdash institution was instituted again by Moshe. Moshe means referring to Moshe as the head of the Sanhedrin. Later on, that was A. B, he said what Yeshua did. And Yeshua instituted that which we say, Noda Lecha, Hashem, on Shechalkov, Sen Eretz, Kamatai Rechova. We thank Hashem for giving us Eretz Yisrael. The original Nusach of that was by Yeshua. Again, it was a legislation. Because one is mandated to say that Nusach now. On page 10 we discuss, these are, in terms of civil
law that when Yeshua was under him, under his auspices, the Jews conquered the land, divided the land, but gave rights to the populace as a whole, even though the land was divided to individuals, and one is individual property, one has private rights, but there are rights of the community as a whole which override private. And just to give you a thing, just from the beginning and the end, you could read this yourself. One is that livestock be permitted to pasture in woods. Now there's an area that doesn't harm anyone, but it's a wooded area which does not really cause real harm. It isn't a place where crops are being, but still it's private property. So if it's in wooded areas, they allowed people to, the shepherds to graze their flocks. Just the final one, so again, you can read them all. If one finds a mace mitzvah, find a corpse, someone died on the road. There's no one there to help, there's no relatives. So you're instructed to bury the person immediately, even if it means you're burying on private property, but the public need takes precedence over the private property, and one is allowed, required, to mace mitzvah koinah mekoimah. He acquires that place and he is buried there. Again, this is all from Yeshua.
What was Yeshua gave reasons for what he did, or just gave?
Yeah, no. These are all just basically for the public good. It was impossible. And as we have again, there's always the balance between the needs of the public and the needs of the individuals. See, we deal with legislation of the time of David HaMelech. Again, and this is showing you that things kept on changing in terms of legislation. The time of David HaMelech, after the incident of Amnon and Tamar, there was legislation that prohibited an unmarried woman being secluded with a man. Of course, they can't have relations. They can't even be secluded. Of course, with a married woman, that was prohibited by the Torah itself. But here it says rabbinically, so that became prohibited. We quote here on page 10, in number 2. There's a medrash. It's a midbar rabbah that the origin, we say 100 brachas every day, if you daven for the Shemoneh Esrei, for all the brachas. So there's brachas really on every part of our, touches every part of our life. The origin is from David HaMelech. Later on, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah put more of a firm stamp on it, and how it said, the Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, the firm stand on the words. But the idea that there should be 100 brachas was instituted by David HaMelech. And his, again, David means through David's Beis Din. Boini Yerushalayim, the Nusaf that we say, Boini Yerushalayim, the original ones were created by David and Shlomo. Erevin, you know, there's an Erev here in the city. There really is two parts of the Erev. An Erev is if we have an area which is enclosed, assuming that the enclosure is something that's accepted as being enclosed. But one cannot, by rabbinic law, one cannot carry out from your private domain to a public, semi-public domain. Even if it would be all enclosed. For instance, in many, you go in Yerushalayim, you have the old Meir Shorim, you find a chutzah. You'll have an area where it's an enclosed area, but there are private homes in an enclosed area. The enclosed area is open access for all the people who live in these various homes. The home, that area is no longer private, it's semi-private. It's used by all of these people. So I'm carrying out from a total private domain, my home, to the semi-private area of this, the courtyard. Since there's a certain appearance, it looks like it came from a private to a public, Shlomo HaMelech forbade caring. But he allowed there to be what we call like a legal fiction, making an Erev, having a common meal
in one of the homes, this meal now belongs to everyone. It's as if everyone lived in this one home and they all lived together. So it's no longer a private to public. It's all the same. Again, it's a legal fiction, but it was made that it no longer resembles totally the private to a public, and people will not make an error. That's why in the Young Israel, there's a box of matzahs that belongs to every one of us here. What? Yeah, this is the matzah. You see, Ruben Chatzeres. You see on the top. That's based on Shlomo HaMelech. Legislation. The question about error of those who don't are not the question of the actual error here so much as a question of it being a fenced in area. How valid are the machitzas? And that's a different question here. Shlomo HaMelech, it seems, was we spoke before about shnias, about the secondary relations. A grandmother, for instance. Torah forbids a mother, rabbinically a grandmother, wouldn't have relations. That was instituted in Shlomo's time. So again, you just want you to see that there's an increment, there's an evolution here. There's a beautiful medrash here. Maybe it's worthwhile just to read this together. In Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, that was instituted in the time, originally in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and later became, at least at the time this medrash is written, was common custom then. When Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, he built two gateways. One for chasanim, bridegrooms, and the other one for avelim, mourners, and menudim, those who were placed under a ban. On Shabbos, the populace would sit between these two gateways. They were able to identify those who were entering through the gateway of bridegroom as being chasanim, and would say to them, "He who dwells in this house shall grant you the joy of having sons and daughters." They're also able to identify those who are entering through the gateway of the mourners as being avelim. If their upper lip was covered by their cloaks, they would then say to them, in other words, they look like avelim, even though it's a question on Shabbos. Not, "He who dwells in this house shall grant you comfort." Those who enter the gateway of mourners, but whose upper lip was not covered by their cloaks, would be identified by them as being menuda, someone placed under a ban. They would tell him, "He who dwells in this house shall place within your heart the inspiration to listen to the words of your colleagues and to place within the hearts of your colleagues the inspiration to forgive you, to draw you close to them." All of this was done in order that all of Israel fulfill their obligation of gemilas chasodim, bestowing kindness. From the time that the temple was destroyed, the sages of blessed memory instituted the chasanim avelim should go to the synagogues and study halls, and the people who recognized the chasam would rejoice with him, and those who recognized the oval would sit on the floor and commiserate with him. This was done in order that all Israel fulfill their obligation bestowing kindness. Regarding them was the following prayer formulated: "Blessed are you, Hashem, who grants a goodly reward for those who bestow kindness." And it's a beautiful, but again, they found there was a need, and there was legislation. Hallel, that goes on a yontif. We say hallel was a legislation. It's a question when it began to say the hallel. This is more in Pesachim. Was it instituted from the very beginning or in later period of time of David HaMelech and later? It means the prophets. The laws of Mukta, we just quote from this Gemara in Shabbos in Lamed Aleph on Beis. It's not clear when it started, but it was clear when David HaMelech died, there was a question of moving him. And there was a question of feeding the dogs that had to, and it was a Shabbos, and Shlomo HaMelech now, he's the son, has all this responsibility. He went to the Sanhedrin and asked, "What should I do?" And he said that a carcass that died is not Mukta. And you could feed it to the animals, according to this Gemara. But David HaMelech was Muksa. And could not, David HaMelech was Muksa, and he couldn't be moved unless something was placed on him. This is a bread or a child in order to move him. There's a question, but evidently the laws of Muksa were in place then. You can read yourself with the others. Just wanted to show you that it was over time, the fasts that were created after the destruction of the temple, there was rabbinic legislation. Purim is rabbinic legislation. And actually the Malbim understands the verse that Esther wanted to be binding legislation to keep Purim. He says that you see the fasts were instituted during this time and were binding upon all of Israel. So too, says, shall Purim, which is a celebration of the Yontif, of the survival of the Jewish people, should also, says, be binding. I'd like to conclude this lecture with an overview of the traditional view of the power of minhag. Up until now we're discussing rabbinic legislation. What about minhag, minhagim? And again, this is an area where the traditionalists oppose the efforts of the reform. Hereafter, I speak here on page 14. I go through that which is instituted by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. You can look again. This is the nusach of the davening that we have. The various that became part of Jewish life. Here on the bottom of page 15, I first quote a Gemara in Pesachim in Nun Amud Beis in 50b. The citizens of Bashan were accustomed not to go from Tyre to Sidon, this is in Sidon, on the eve of Shabbos. They didn't travel. I mean, it seems there was a market day that day, but they didn't travel. They were afraid they wouldn't get back in time for Shabbos. So they avoided the market. Their children went to Rabbi Yochanan and said to them, "Or for our fathers this was possible. They could make enough of a living, you know, the other days of the week. But for us it's impossible. We have to be involved in this market." Said he to them, "Your fathers have already taken it upon themselves, as it said, Shema b'ni Musa avich v'al titash Torah semecha. Hear my son, the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the teachings of thy mother." In your community, that has become the minhag already, the custom, it is binding. Customs are binding. Here we are on page 16. We discuss in paragraph B, there are different places had minhagim, had customs about not to do work, Erev Pesach, before Chatzos. After Chatzos, after midday, seems universally it's forbidden to do, we treat it like Chol HaMoed. Any work that could be done on Chol HaMoed could be done then, but otherwise we treat it normally you should not work after Chatzos. There's a start from the beginning of the day, before midday. And there's, again, that there are different customs. And if you go, there's the whole thing, if I go from a place that has the custom not to work, and I go to a place that they do work, what should I do? And it says, if your place, the custom is not to work, you are bound by the customs of your place. If it's going to be a quarrel or something else, but people not working, there's no quarrel. You're not working because you have nothing to do. It's not evident that you're doing something that's offensive to the people of this place. But when it's a situation where it's not offensive and there's no arguments, you're bound to follow the custom of your original place. And if I see something, there's a custom. Things are permitted, but they've accepted upon themselves to be forbidden. Says, I can't, in their presence, I should honor them. Even though I'm not of their place, I don't have to, I see them doing things. I have to respect what they have, and there's really they're bound by it. People are bound by their custom, their own customs, and the customs of their forefathers.
And the custom of the place that they come to, they have to act as the Romans do?
That's right. That's right. They shouldn't come. Right, that's right. Now, there's a area of custom. One is, so here we're dealing with the custom in terms of it being similar to a vow. In other words, I've accepted upon myself certain behavior, and at least rabbinically it's binding. There's other area of custom which really defines halacha. And here is they quote this often. There was a question, there's the practice of chalitza, you know, the taking off the shoe, the person dies without any children, and the brother has the option, according to Torah law, either of marrying the widow or voiding the relation is through this ceremony of chalitza. The chalitza could be done taking off a shoe or taking off a sandal. So it says, if Eliyahu would come and declare the chalitza may be performed with foot covering shoe, he would be obeyed. However, to declare the chalitza may not be formed with a sandal, which was the common custom, he would not be obeyed, for the people not have long ago adopted the practice of performing with a sandal, and that is the equivalent of a halacha itself. As the minog is as an equivalent of being legislation, but it has the equivalent of legislation that everyone is doing it, and it has a thing in even defining halacha. Normally, there are rules. When you have a question of halacha, that there is a minority opinion that holds one way, a majority holds another way. It isn't something that they sat down in a Sanhedrin and voted on. But I just happen to know that. You know, you say Rav Moshe holds like this one and this one holds like that. There are different authorities that hold in different ways. We normally have a rule of thumb. The normal rule is that if you don't know what to do, if you're the Talmud of somebody, okay, I'm a Talmud. He's my Rebbe. He's the Mor d'Asra. I follow him, what he says. I don't have any minhag. So if the person, the people that are of one group are the majority and the other is minority. Yochad v'rabim, halacha k'rabim, you go with the majority. If they're not, it's not clear who's the majority. But one is greater in stature and inferior, go that which is greater. But there's a idea of the minhog. If the common custom is to follow one of those poskim, it says, that is the halacha. And if there's a Gemara here in Brachas that deals with a different questions, that there was really a minority opinion or whatever that followed one way, but everyone accepted that already becomes the equivalent, like that person is the Mor d'Asra, that person would have been the Rebbe in that place. Everyone would have listened to him. If the custom is to accept that person, that accept that ruling, that becomes halacha as well. And that we find the halacha of the customs is minhogim shol yisrael. I have on paragraph F on page 16. Minhogim shol yisrael teirihi. And as we find the rishonim use that certain, the custom has already defined his paskin this halacha. He knows a question, but since everyone has accepted this opinion. And this is where there's a thing says that from Masechta the Sefer, you know, halacha says the minigs is brechta halacha, you know, has more of a habit. But basically is that the people have accepted upon themselves this opinion, it's binding. It's as if that person is their Rebbe and has. In the next lecture, we turn to the Reform Rabbinic Assemblies of Frankfurt and Breslau and touch upon the reforms that they advocated and direction of the Reform movement in the aftermath of these Rabbinic Assemblies. But I wanted to devote this particular lecture when we're dealing with change and reform to understand what are the mechanics of change. You know, to understand that it is change is really extremely limited. Right? Yeah, yeah. And to understand, so I just want just to chaser this over, just because it was, I said an awful lot. But,
yeah. How time bound is this? Apparently, there's no limit that you say, I'm checking yes,
but. Yeah, you're asking about me.
Does it become halacha? Or if there's a.
Perhaps, yeah, it depends, perhaps. Yeah. Let me just chaser this over, just because of the complexity of this. It's the whole. I just wanted to chaser. Let me just chaser over this thing here. We spoke about the nature of
rabbinic legislation. The point of the Torah itself, as regards to marital relations, as regard to the Nozer itself, created fences. And there's a mandate for the Rabbanim when they see fit to create, to add to the Torah. Now, it's not the Torah itself, it's only a fence. And it's clear that there are guidelines that apply to rabbinic law that are separate than Torah law. There are leniencies of it, and to make it clear that it's rabbinic law. But nonetheless, there is idea of fences and the idea of legislation. And it seems that it's the Torah itself mandated, gave them that power. And the Rabbanan, it seems, it's often quoted, this loy saucer, which is read, it's interpreted not only to interpretation, to the psak, understand, but also to legislation. We went to the, so here they have the right. Once a law has been legislated, it depends, though, do the people accept it or don't accept it. If they don't accept it, it seems right out. They just don't accept it. It's clear no one accepts this. It seems like Kiblu, from other Gemara, is that it doesn't become law. It has to be accepted. But if it's not clear if it's accepted or not, many people start doing this. It could be it's already accepted or not. You really have to analyze it. Once it's it's in the process of becoming accepted, it wasn't like refused outright, it's in the process of being accepted, it's still binding until another court comes and says, listen, it hasn't been accepted, it's just not worthwhile to press on, and we're voiding it. And they have the right to void it under those circumstances. We spoke about the idea if there's an argument, it was stated in the Mishnah, there's a majority and minority regarding this, an inferior court, a subsequent court, can rule according to the minority. That if there's a stated reason in the legislation, and the reason is no longer applicable, again, an inferior court can analyze this and decide already now so it could be voided. But before they do that, it's still in force. And also, if the original legislation, there was a proviso, there was a clause in the original allowing for a later court to void it, they have the power to do so. Otherwise, though, rabbinic legislation is in its force and it's binding. You just can't come, a group of rabbis can't come and say, we aren't going to keep it anymore. We also showed at the end of the, that it has been incremental. In other words, there was the Torah, and then with the rabbinic legislation that we have today is really part of a history that has gone through the ages, so to speak, until we have now. But we went also to the thing of custom, and there's the thing of a widespread custom. Now, there are customs that is not widespread in a place, but they show us that the Adam Godel, a great person, used to do this. And basically, it's highly suggested, but it's not. This is not binding. So much of the customs that we have today are customs. They're nice. You know, people eat latkes on Hanukkah. That means oil. They now have to sell this is some ganiyot. They have it. You know, it's a nice thing to have. It's not binding. You know, they're. There's certain anhogas, if I Adam Godel used to do this or that. They're not universally binding. But if a person individual started doing this and accepted upon himself and then enhanced himself, then already it's a Kabbalah. Then already for the individual, then it becomes like a vow. That's why when we're Matur in the Dorim, you know, in the Arab Rosh Hashanah, we speak about the I was Makabal, I didn't say Beli Neder. You know, a Kabbalah, if one starts accepting upon himself, it has the force of a neder and it needs annulment. Otherwise, it has its force. So there's the custom that individual does. There's a custom of a place and it has to be honored. And it goes in generations. This is where I come from and this is the custom. It was like the B'nai Baishan that they didn't go to the market day of Shabbos because if it will interfere with the Shabbos, the next generation is bound by it. So there is custom, which is the halachic custom, which is binding. Yeah.
What about that wording in the Atarata Darim that we say, Rashad, I think that it should also apply to the things for the upcoming year?
So you're asking about the Atarata Darim. I'll just as a side, this is not, is that the Gemara in Chof Gimel and Darim speaks about the possibility of pre-annulment. In other words, that I'm saying now that anything that I'm annulling before it happens, if I forget, I don't realize, whatever it is, and that's based on that Gemara. There's two kinds of annulment. Right?
And how was it disseminated, an enactment that we should say that, like, some people wasn't taken on by a lot of Tadis or not? How does one, especially if it was the best in the year, how did an enactment get widespread and be taken on?
You're asking about how does it become widespread. Generally, what the Gemara is speaking about, we're speaking about enactments that were made by the Sanhedrin, or or after the destruction of the temple, but it was the equivalent of the Sanhedrin. They were recognized as the leadership.
So it wasn't like a small little bezin.
No, that's right. It was as the leadership. After the time of the Chasimus HaTalmud, the Talmud was finished, and you had the period of the Gaonim, and the Rabbanim were not into one area, but there were different yeshivas, right. Unless the Gaonim themselves, the yeshivas, came together in a joint session, they did not have the power to make legislation. There were occasions, rare. But we don't have that anymore.
When we finally come to, let's say, your pre-Holocaust, where different communities have taken upon themselves different things for their own environment, and that not necessarily, an example, like Sephardim and Ashkenazim, the Yarmulke and other things.
So you're asking about, so again, so different places had different customs. If you're a member of that community, you come from there, you're still bound by those, like the B'nai Baishan, you're of that community. And if you've given up totally that community, and you became a member of another community, are not going to go back to that community, then you're able to change, because now I became integrated in this new community, and I'm not going back to the old community at all. So then I take on the customs of this new community.
You have to take with you that.
Yeah, right, yeah. If I'm still my independent, I'm still part of that community, then you're bound by all the customs of that community. Yeah? Ha-gut-tabach.